Today, we're bringing you, Inform Your Resistance listeners, a special preview episode in between our regularly scheduled monthly episodes. PRA and Diaspora Alliance's new six-part miniseries, Lifting the Curtain on Antisemitism, is available today on the PRA Presents channel. We're dropping episode one here so you can tune in today and subscribe to PRA Presents to receive all six episodes. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Lifting the Curtain on Antisemitism, a six-part podcast miniseries from Political Research Associates and Diaspora Alliance. I'm your co-host, Shoshana Brown, with Ben Lorber.
That's me. We will be talking to experts who will help us investigate antisemitism and its weaponization from various angles, from unpacking conspiracy theories to examining the conflation between antisemitism and criticism of Israel, to exploring how to confront antisemitism as progressives. We hope to give you the tools to navigate current debates, understand the threats we face in our climates of rising authoritarianism, and inform your resistance from the U.S. to Israel, Palestine, and around the world. Hello, and welcome to Lifting the Curtain on Antisemitism. I'm your co-host, Ben Lorber.
And I'm Shoshana Brown. Glad you decided to press play, tune in, and join the journey towards liberation. That's what this is ultimately all about. And we're going to help you, the listener, understand anti-Semitism and how it's at play. There's so much noise about what anti-Semitism is or isn't, and we're navigating times of unprecedented debate, use, and misuse of anti-Semitism.
And sometimes folks who are new to all these issues get overwhelmed by all of the different perspectives and the very loud debates on antisemitism, and they decide to tune the issue out entirely. Or movement activists get so fed up by all the false charges of antisemitism that are directed against Palestine solidarity organizing that they decide that antisemitism itself isn't worth understanding or taking seriously. But we believe it is possible and more important than ever to dig in and understand antisemitism from a social justice framework.
In this short podcast series, we will define antisemitism, track how it is operating within U.S. politics and on the global stage, while speaking to guests about what they recommend as hopeful strategies for winning liberation for everyone.
I think we should start a bit with like who we are and how we got into this work and what we bring to it. Shoshana, I wonder how you've gotten into this. What brought you here and what experiences do you draw from in this work?
Well, such a winding road, honestly. I have been a longtime prison abolition organizer. That's where I got my sea legs as an organizer and as somebody who cares deeply about social justice and human rights. And so as a prison abolition organizer, during the Black Lives Matter uprisings, I looked for ways to impact my more local politics because I was doing work on a statewide level. And I wanted to dig in a bit more granularly to intentionally infuse a politic of abolition inside of the local political organizing that was happening around police reform. And that's really how I found my way to JFRJ, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, and then later became a co-founder of the Black Jewish Liberation Collective when I realized that there was really no space for Black Jews to amplify, uplift, organize, and be together in community. So I started this organization called Black Jewish Liberation Collective and have done a ton of organizing since. And that's when I started to learn about anti-Semitism. And I really came into my politic around Israel-Palestine. Like prior to that, I really was quiet on the issue and scared. I was nervous to take a stance. I didn't know what was real and what wasn't. I had a lot of conflicting information, and it all seemed too overwhelming to get tangled up in. So I just chose to focus my organizing on Black liberation, on the prison industrial complex and prison abolitionism. But as I started to organize amongst my people, amongst Black Jews, I really began to understand anti-Semitism. And it was only after truly understanding anti-Semitism that I felt strong enough to have a clear politic, because so much of it was mired with anti-Semitism or fears of anti-Semitism. And it was really in that safe space of Black Jewish Liberation Collective, where I had other Black Jews that I could talk to about these issues, where I really came into understanding both anti-Semitism and also the importance of fighting for liberation in Palestine.
Yeah. Wow. Thanks for sharing your journey. I'm wondering, like, what was going on in the world at the time when you felt like you had enough grounding on anti-Semitism to kind of tackle Israel-Palestine? Like, was there like a moment when that shift happened for you that you remember?
I would say that I started to get clear, but it really was after October 7th that my thinking about it and my public persona got crystal clear. I, for a long time before that, had been in lots of private conversations with trusted advisors, with trusted comrades, friends in the social justice movement who were helping me think through some of these issues, think through where my understandings came from, and really unpack a lot of the things that were getting in my way. And when I saw October 7th happen, it was horrific. And then I knew immediately what would come after, because I'd been in these private conversations and had been already learning about what the process would be, like what the response would be and what we could expect. And it was in that moment that I knew that there had to be another way forward. And it was only through speaking out and being clear about speaking out that I was a Black Jew, and that this also impacted me as much as it impacted my family, as much as it has impacted my community, that it wasn't something far away. A lot of times I use that excuse. Oh, that's something on the other side of the world that really doesn't impact me. Like, prisons impact me every day. My community, I see people getting arrested. I've had loved ones arrested. I've had loved ones imprisoned. This is something that's directly impacting me. And I used that excuse for a long time to avoid talking about Palestine. And it was after October 7th when I knew, I had a sense of what would come, that I knew I was in a position to speak out, and I can no longer use those excuses to shirk responsibility and the role that I had now played, particularly as I grew in my activism and my leadership. I had a responsibility as a leader in this community, as one of the co-founders of Black Jewish Liberation Collective, to speak out and be clear about it. But I'm curious about you, Ben. How did you get here?
I'm just sitting with what you were sharing and just how, since October 7th and definitely before it, we've all seen just how it's impossible to keep the conflict, you know, over there. It's structuring our national politics so much, and especially the attacks coming at our movements. And we're going to talk about that, of course, in future episodes. But yeah, in 2011, 1 year after I got out of college, I went on a trip to Israel, you know, for American Jews to learn more about our Jewish identities and to connect with Israel. It was kind of like a birthright program, except more religious. And I spent some time there studying in a yeshiva, which did deepen my Jewish identity. But I'd also heard about the occupation. I had a basic sense that something wasn't right, and I wanted to learn more. And some friends helped me get connected to activists in the West Bank, and I ended up leaving the yeshiva and spending several months doing solidarity work in the West Bank. And it was really those 6 months of my life, you know, deepening my Jewish identity on the one hand, and at the same time, like being face to face with the brutality of occupation and apartheid, that really set me on my course. And I spent some years working in like the Jewish Palestine Solidarity Movement. I ended up working for Jewish Voice for Peace for a few years, where I was their campus organizer. And so I really saw firsthand there, and this was right when things like Canary Mission were just getting started, which we'll talk about in future episodes. But basically this wave of attempts to demonize Palestinian students and other students who were speaking out on campuses as anti-Semitic. You know, I saw firsthand how first-generation Palestinian students who just wanted their university to stop funding the companies like Boeing that were dropping bombs on their families in Gaza, they were being silenced by these false charges of anti-Semitism. And so I saw that firsthand. And then also, this is around in 2018, like with Charlottesville and the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, the issue of anti-Semitism and the alt-right really became very pressing. And I spent like a lot of time just kind of going down rabbit holes on the internet and really trying to understand their anti-Semitism and what motivated this reactionary movement that was like sweeping the country. And I started working for Political Research Associates, where I work now in 2019, and where I monitor and write about anti-Semitism and white nationalism. And so I really see my work as right where you stand also, Shoshana, and where so many of us stand, of like trying both to fight anti-Semitism and the ways that the anti-Semitism is weaponized against Palestine solidarity organizing.
That must have been a really powerful experience going from Israel and going into Palestine and seeing directly what is happening there.
Yeah, it was really eye-opening, and it was hard to integrate, because when I went to at the yeshiva first, I really appreciated like a lot of the Jewish education and the deepening understanding I gained there. And it was really hard to disentangle it from the pro-Israel kind of propaganda and from the racism I encountered. And I think we're all still on that journey of trying to build a Judaism beyond nationalism and to bear witness and to resist what's being done in our name.
And we hope that you as a listener will join us on this journey, because we've been at this for many years, disentangling these webs of understanding and fighting for liberation. So I work at Diaspora Alliance, which is an international organization fighting anti-Semitism and its instrumentalization. And I'm the director of pedagogy and training there. So I do a lot of work to help translate a lot of the big thinking that comes out of academic resources, big textbooks, so that everyday organizers who aren't focused on anti-Semitism, but maybe are focused on immigration or elections or Black liberation can really understand this and integrate this analysis into their organizing so that it stops being a stumbling block. Because so often anti-Semitism just rears its ugly head right when we're making progress, like right when we're winning, all of a sudden something happens. And I remember that so viscerally during the Movement for Black Lives, when they put out their platform and there was so much momentum around Black liberation, around racial justice. And they wrote in their platform that they are in solidarity with Palestine. And that became a huge stumbling block for racial justice and the work towards racial justice. So a lot of my work is trying to help people understand that so we can get ahead of it and we can make sure that our movements are fortified in not only the instrumentalization or the way that anti-Semitism is used to divide our movements, but also to make sure that our movements aren't anti-Semitic and that Jews and all people are welcome in our movements.
That was something, else that, really has brought me as well to really sit at this intersection is the years that I've spent in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. I think I had the experience that many folks, Jewish and non-Jewish, have had of realizing that at the same time that we're being hit by all these false accusations of anti-Semitism, we ourselves so often don't have a good understanding of what anti-Semitism is. We're a lot better at saying what it is not. but it's a lot harder to say what it is and to ensure that it doesn't show up in our organizing unintentionally. And also that helps us be prepared when we are hit with these cynical accusations. So yeah, I really appreciate you naming that. And I work at Political Research Associates. We are a social movement think tank that's been around since the early 1980s, and we track the right and we help progressives fight the right. I feel like for many years, we were a voice in the wilderness. You know, we were raising the warning of the rising Christian right, the rising white nationalist right, and trying to get journalists and organizers to take it seriously. And then obviously with the rise of the MAGA movement and Trumpism, it's become unavoidable. And my role there is I focus on anti-Semitism and white nationalism and increasingly Christian Zionism, which we'll talk about as well. And like you, Shoshana, like Diaspora Alliance, we really try to be a resource to social movements to help folks understand the threats that we face and strategize to defeat authoritarianism and to build a vibrant multiracial democracy.
I feel like it's about time that we begin to define for our audience all the words we've been using. We've been talking a lot, and part of the thing that makes fighting anti-Semitism so challenging is that there is so much jargon, there's so many words, and it can feel like, for many people, a niche conversation. And we want to break that down. We don't want this to be a niche conversation anymore. We want everybody to be able to fully engage in the conversation without feeling nervous to step on minefields and without feeling nervous that they're going to say the wrong thing.
Let's maybe start by defining anti-Semitism. Should be easy enough, right? Maybe not. Shoshana, do you want to kick us off?
We understand anti-Semitism as hostility, discrimination, prejudice, and violence towards Jews as Jews. Anti-Semitism most often operates as conspiracy theories, like when Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban's party launched a campaign targeting George Soros, a Hungarian Holocaust survivor and philanthropist. Well, the campaign implied that Soros was secretly plotting to bring migrants into Hungary. But the original idea for the anti-Soros messaging was from two American Jewish political consultants, as we'll learn about in the next episode. So you should stay tuned.
I think we're not used to thinking about conspiracy theories. That's something that, you know, often cannot look like other forms of oppression. And as this example illustrates, this is something that sometimes Jews can participate in. Parts of the Jewish community or the state of Israel can also play a role in fomenting these conspiracy theories. So there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. Because just like any oppression, just because you are the subject of the oppression doesn't necessarily mean that you know how it's operating, though you may be experiencing the impacts, right? And anti-Semitic rhetoric and behavior holds Jews collectively responsible for society's ills or perceived evils in the world, and that results in marginalization, persecution, and violence.
I think there's a thing about anti-Semitism that sometimes it doesn't target Jews. And what does that mean? Like, we have to really unpack that. Obviously, there are ways where Jews are undoubtedly the target, the object of anti-Semitism. You know, when a Jewish person is harassed on the street or a swastika is spray painted on a synagogue, there's no question there. But if you turn on Fox News today, as we'll get into, you'll hear all these conspiracy theories that George Soros is plotting to bring in non-white immigrants or like a cultural Marxist cabal is working in the academy to mainstream transgender ideology. And sometimes these conspiracy theories, they're rooted in anti-Semitism. They're rooted in these age-old ideas that have been developed about Jews for centuries in Christian Europe. And then the right turns around and takes these ideas and weaponizes them against trans folks or against immigrants. It's part of this broader anti-democratic political project that uses these conspiracy theories to explain the world. So sometimes it's about Jews, and it's not even about Jews at all. So yet another way that this stuff can be confusing.
Let's back up a bit and give a brief history of anti-Semitism, and then we'll go into some frameworks for understanding what we mean.
Thank you.
obviously, we can't cover it all. Anti-Semitism has taken a lot of forms over the centuries, but it really has its roots in Christian Europe. From the very beginning of Christianity, which evolved out of Judaism, the early Christians had to explain, if we have the truth that, you know, Jesus is the Messiah that was prophesied in the Jewish scriptures, why are these Jews still around? These Jews who don't recognize Jesus like we want them to. So early on, Judaism was kind of a core theological problem for Christianity. And then as Christianity became the dominant, you know, religion in the Roman Empire and became allied with state power, Jews were demonized more and more as the enemies of God, or the embodiment of evil, Christ killers. And Christians used the state, you know, to exclude Jews, to segregate Jews, to target Jews for persecution, sometimes for pogroms and expulsion and worse.
Throughout Europe, in every single European empire, at some point there was some kind of conspiracy theory that told the masses to blame their anger on the Jews for whatever reason as a way to continue to maintain or grow in power. Many Jews were excluded from most professions except professions that were tied to money lending and banking. So, of course, many people might be familiar with a trope like Jews are good with money or Jews are greedy, things like that.
And I think you said it really well, that often the rulers of these empires kind of told the masses to channel their righteous anger at Jews. You know, like peasants in Europe suffered so much exploitation at the hands of feudalism. And often, instead of targeting their anger at the Christian nobles and the feudal lords who were kind of in keeping the whole system in place and profiting from the widespread misery, these princes and the priests who were allied with them would say, no, take your anger out on the Jewish moneylender instead. They killed Jesus. They are the evil enemy. And so many of these pogroms in Europe happened during times of great unrest and unhappiness. And it was a tool for the ruling class to kind of keep their power by diverting the anger onto a false scapegoat.
And this led to lots of expulsions, segregations, forced conversions, and other discrimination. That's part of how we have such a large Jewish diaspora.
I think it's also important to say here, this was the experience often in Europe, not all the time in Europe, but often in various contexts, but it's not the universal Jewish experience. You know, so often the mainstream narrative on anti-Semitism is one of endless persecution through the ages. And it's actually important to look not only in moments in Europe where Jews lived in relative stability, like under Muslim Spain for many centuries, but also beyond Europe. You know, Jewish life throughout the Middle East and North Africa and Asia was often characterized by, there was certainly persecution, but there were also long periods of relative coexistence and stability, even thriving and flourishing within civilizations that exhibited more tolerance. And so it's important to avoid a Eurocentric framing that only looks at these experiences that we've been describing.
And even in West Africa, where there are Jewish communities, I would say that no matter where you look, a lot of Jewish communities, no matter where they were, when experiencing anti-Semitism, those spaces were often impacted by European Christian imperialism or colonization. So that's also in the mix somehow there too. But I don't want to get too deep into the weeds of it.
That's so important, just to avoid looking at anti-Semitism in isolation, but to see in every moment it's always connected to other systems of oppression. Moving into the more modern era, the last couple hundred years, these deep-seated European tropes about Jews evolved into conspiracy theories. The story that an all-powerful Jewish cabal is at the root of society's problems. There's kind of like a hidden group of Jews behind the economy or the government or the media or Hollywood who are to blame in times of crisis and unrest and discontent. Much like we said about earlier phases of history, especially when people are fed up, when society is in crisis and people are eager for someone to blame, These conspiracy theories can be an image of power as a place to point your finger and say, that's the root cause of our trouble. And it's so convenient, you know, for the real elites, the real 1% of our society to use these conspiracy theories because it prevents folks from coming at them.
One way that I like to explain how this operates is through an image, a metaphor of a factory. And in this factory, there are lots of machines that operate together to create the final product. If we're going to think about this factory as a factory of oppression, I think about these machines inside of the factory as a machine of white supremacy, a machine of patriarchy, a machine of capitalism, and a machine of Christian supremacy. When I say Christian supremacy, and when we talk about it here on this podcast, we're not talking about individual Christians. We're not talking about a relationship to God, a belief system, or a community. What we're talking about is when a government uses Christian faith as a tool for power and as a weapon. It is really a weaponization of the Christian faith. And that's what I mean when I say Christian supremacy. And just like any factory that you think of, all factories create some kind of pollution. And I think of this pollution as including racism, sexism, classism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. Sometimes that pollution is smog, really visible, and sometimes you don't really see it. That doesn't mean that the pollution isn't there.
Yeah, there's so much I love about that metaphor. And one of the things is this imagery of like a factory and so many different machines that have to work together is just such a perfect way to understand the way that anti-Semitism can be deeply connected to other forms of oppression. Like if we look at the history of the worst anti-Semitic attack to occur in the U.S., the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in October 2018, the shooter was a white nationalist who was radicalized through anti-immigrant xenophobia. At that time, you know, it was shortly before the midterms of 2018, and the GOP and Fox News were talking overtime that, you know, a migrant caravan was coming to the U.S.-Mexico border to bring in immigrants by the Democrats, right, to destroy our civilization. And this white nationalist shooter, he was posting on the right-wing media site, a Gab, every day about the migrant caravan and about George Soros, who was bringing in immigrants to destroy the country. This stuff was all throughout the right-wing ecosystem. And that shooter targeted that synagogue in Pittsburgh because it was working with HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, an American Jewish organization that's helped refugees and immigrants for decades. And so for that shooter, anti-Semitism and anti-immigrant racism were deeply connected. They're inextricable there. Just like that factory needs all those pieces to work, all these pieces all fit together. I just love the way that metaphor helps to break it down.
And I think one of the things that we're seeing right now is the way that anti-Semitism is an easy out and an escape tool for those who are in power. It also operates kind of as a false power analysis, right? Some people will call this smokescreen anti-Semitism or instrumentalized anti-Semitism or even weaponized anti-Semitism.
You know, like there's a reason that Elon Musk works so hard to spread conspiracy theories that George Soros is controlling the media. You know, he'll say that George Soros is this, you know, billionaire who's behind the government and the media. Meanwhile, Elon Musk is literally the richest man on the planet, who's literally, you know, controlling our information ecosystem.
Literally in the government.
Yeah, it's a deflection. It doesn't only appear on the right. It's, like you said, it's part of the air we breathe. It can be suffused throughout our popular culture. It can be on the left as well. It can be in New Age movements and self-help movements. It can be everywhere. And it's especially powerful for authoritarian and right-wing movements to scapegoat their enemies. And that's something that we're going to come back to, especially in the next episode.
That's another way that things start getting really confusing. And you'll hear about this in a future episode, but even the definition and understanding what anti-Semitism is or is not has become a battleground. Because one of the strategies for shifting power and deflecting is how we come to understand what anti-Semitism is or is not. And there's endless media noise devoted to parsing out what is or isn't anti-Semitism, but this series will help you parse out the signals from the noise in what can be an overwhelming landscape.
And as we've said before, you know, too often charges of anti-Semitism are instrumentalized to shut down those who want to call out and build power to combat Israel's oppression of Palestinians or the ideology of Zionism. And we see how dangerous this can be as Jewish people who believe in human rights and justice, who are supporters of Palestinian freedom and equality. Now more than ever, we see how dangerous this can be, especially since October 7th, and even more with the new Trump administration, where the administration is saying Shalom Mahmoud, is claiming to speak in the name of protecting Jews as they snatch up Palestinian students, you know, off the street and dismantle universities and further authoritarianism in so many ways.
So, if this is the wrong way to fight anti-Semitism, if deporting Palestinian students and revoking funding from universities is the wrong way to fight anti-Semitism, well, what's the alternative? We have a few ideas for you, but we don't want to leave you on a down note because we just went through a lot of really hard history and a lot of bummers, honestly. And we want to give you some things to look forward to. So just as a preview, in episode 6, we talk about the importance of building horizontal instead of vertical alliances. So often in Jewish history, we have sought accommodations or alliances with power as a safety strategy. But instead, there are alternative models for what it would look like to build coalitions of solidarity with other marginalized communities. And in practice, this could look a lot of different ways, from community safety strategies that don't rely on policing, joining broad coalition campaigns to fight fascism and to defend each other, doing mutual aid, and even campaigns to end wealth inequality and alienation, so people have less reason to turn to conspiracy theories. But we're still figuring it out. We don't have all the answers. And that's why we need you as a listener to get really skilled up on this analysis, because so many coalition spaces across the country are modeling what this could look like, educating each other about anti-Semitism, showing up, defending each other, deepening relationships. And at the core, it is the realization that we cannot fight anti-Semitism in isolation, apart from other fights. All our struggles are connected.
Before we go through what these episodes have in store for you, I think we wanted to do a little bit of clarifying our language and terminology. So Shoshana, why don't you kick us off?
Oh, right. Because I just said fight anti-Semitism a lot. And we should say how we're talking about eliminating anti-Semitism. Well, some people say eliminating, some people say ending or fighting or combating or dismantling or confronting. All of these are come to mean how do we deal with anti-Semitism? I really like the language of dismantling anti-Semitism because what that references is back to my factory metaphor. It's about dismantling and taking apart all of the ways that anti-Semitism is hooked up into and connected to other systems of power and oppression in our society. And what we need to do is really take it apart. A lot of people, when I'm doing a workshop on anti-Semitism and teaching about anti-Semitism, they'll say, well, like, Jews aren't the only Semitic people. What about Palestinians? What about Arab-speaking people? They're also Semitic people. How come their oppression isn't included in anti-Semitism? There are two ways to look at how we define a word. One is by breaking it down phonetically, like anti-Semitism. Another is to look at the history of the word. Where did it come from? How has it been used in society? And how it is currently used in everyday language by the majority of people? And yes, Jewish people originally used the Hebrew language, and that is part of a family of languages called the Semitic languages. But actually, anti-Semitism, the word, was coined in the late 1800s by a German anti-Semite who actually saw Jews getting equality all across Europe, political equality, and wanted to stop that. And he created this thing called the League of Anti-Semites. And the whole intention was to stop Jews from gaining political equality. So, yeah. When we talk about anti-Semitism, it actually is and always has been specifically about the hatred, hostility, discrimination against Jews as Jews. But this language of, like, some people, instead of calling it anti-Semitism, have started talking about it as Jew hatred. And I personally really don't like this language. I think it reduces anti-Semitism to an interpersonal issue that has to be fought in a method that targets individuals, usually people who don't have access to power or privilege.
And this isn't to say that hatred isn't sometimes a useful description. Obviously, you know, the neo-Nazism that I have to look at sometimes on the internet, there's hatred there, right? White supremacy in the U.S. is suffused with anti-Black hatred. And if we only think about anti-Semitism or any kind of bigotry really as hatred, we miss the structures. We miss, like you said, the way that it's all part of a factory. We miss the way it all fits together, and we miss kind of seeing how it changes over time. And it really doesn't help us in our political work. So that's why we tend to avoid things like Jew hatred. Don't get me started on the phrase, the world's oldest hatred is another one that comes up here that's just not helpful. You know, we throw around a lot of different terms to talk about the way that authoritarians use anti-Semitism toward their anti-democratic means. Sometimes we'll say instrumentalization. Sometimes we'll say a weaponization. Sometimes we'll say smokescreen anti-Semitism. And I think all these can be a little bit interchangeable, I think. They all get at ways in which those in power use, you know, anti-Semitism or charges of anti-Semitism toward their own ends. And when someone like Trump is tweeting Shalom Mahmoud and announcing that ICE just rounded up Mahmoud Khalil, they're not doing it because they care about Jews. They're using this issue, you know, for other purposes. And so I think, you know, ultimately, any of these terms, that's what it gets at. And I think it's helpful to use terms like this because recognizing that none of it really keeps Jews safe. In fact, it isolates Jews from potential allies, right? When rulers, you know, instrumentalize the fight against anti-Semitism, it isolates Jews. It singles out Jews as a separate class for special protection. It uses Jews, our trauma, our history, as a wedge to divide movements. And you see the hypocrisy when someone like Elon Musk will demonize, you know, George Soros or throw up a Nazi salute in one moment and then say he's defending Jews from scary pro-Palestine protesters in the next moment. It's really maddening and hypocritical.
And as I talked about earlier, a lot of this at the core is about Christian supremacy. And I mentioned that this isn't about the spiritual tradition or faith or community, but Soul Force has a beautiful definition, and I'll just read it here. It says, Christian supremacy is what happens when political systems form a parasitic relationship with Christianity. Christian supremacy is not Christianity. It's weaponized religion. And this ultimately is all about ethno-national supremacy writ large. Ultimately, supremacy and systems of domination of any kind, and especially prominent for those that weaponize religious beliefs, are bad for human rights, bad for equity, and bad for justice. But when you have an ideology like Christian supremacy, then the politics of that ideology come to be known as Christian nationalism. And some people even say the foreign policy of Christian nationalism becomes Christian Zionism.
We're going to get into all the ways this can manifest. You know, in the U.S. right now, there's powerful movements that want the U.S. to become a Christian nation, you know, whatever, however they define it as. There's theocratic movements who want to basically twist all the laws in this country so they reflect their exclusionary brand of Christianity. And as Shoshana said, these actors are also fomenting war in the Middle East to bring the end times. So not fun. And we're going to get into all that in future topics. So let's look at some of the episodes that we got coming up on the pipeline.
I'm so excited because the lineup of guest speakers that we have for all of you is just all-star, phenomenal cast of people who really have spent so many years studying these particular aspects of anti-Semitism, not even anti-Semitism broadly, but the particular intersections, the particular things that we are talking about. These are world experts on this. And so in our next episode, we're going to dig further into some of the conspiracy theories that Ben started to tell us about, looking at why anti-Semitism is at the heart of so many conspiracy theories, why they're able to gain traction, and unpacking some of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories we see around us today.
And after that, we're going to have on two experts who are really at the front lines of fighting the instrumentalization of anti-Semitism against Palestine solidarity. These folks are leading researchers and advocates who have been tracking this for decades, and they're going to put it all in context for us and look at some of the policies and the strategies that, you know, that Israel's defenders are using to silence voices who are standing in solidarity with Palestinians in the public square.
In episode 4, we look at anti-Semitism on the far right, both in the U.S. and in Germany, and we look at how the far right utilizes anti-Semitism as part of their strategy.
In episode 5, we look at the intersection of anti-Semitism with racism, looking at the ways that anti-Semitism fits into white supremacy, the ways that, you know, that white supremacy has brought white Jews into its pact with power, and the way this plays out, especially in American domestic politics.
And finally, we'll finish with episode 6, where we look at fighting anti-Semitism as a leftist. And we go to the United Kingdom to speak with an organizer and a journalist in Great Britain about what it's been like to fight anti-Semitism and making international connections, as well as some hope for what we can do as a movement.
We really look forward to embarking on this journey of learning and being in conversation and in movement together.
We'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Lifting the Curtain on Anti-Semitism, a podcast miniseries from Political Research Associates and Diaspora Alliance.
You can find all the episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode was produced by Olivia Lawrence Wallman. Our hosts are Ben Lorber and Shoshana Brown. Original score by Akash Desai. Artwork by Zoe Newton. Our fact checker is Natasha Roth Roland. Sound design and mixing by Thick Skim Media. Also, thank you to Natasha Roth Roland, Simone Zimmerman, M. Hilton, and Koki Mendes for your insights and thought partnership.
To learn more about Political Research Associates, find us at politicalresearch.org or at PRA Eyes Right on Blue Sky. Diaspora Alliance is at www.diasporaalliance.co. Thank you for listening.